Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the hidden items in the Ryan budget, what they could mean for the U.S., and how the campaigns keep them hidden. Then, on the Scholar Circle, throughout U.S. history, third parties have had a profound impact on policy, governance, and voter turnout. So why are we still in a two-party system? Republican vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan has proposed cutting nearly $1 trillion from the so-called allowances in the federal budget. But while many of the cuts target safety net programs, many more remain vague and unspecified. What might the Paul Ryan budget mean for the future of the U.S., and how does it comport with the Republican campaign rhetoric? With us now is Thomas Edsel. He is professor of journalism at Columbia Journalism School, author of numerous books, including The Age of Austerity, Building Red America, and Power and Money, writing about politics. Welcome, Thomas Edsel.
How are you?
Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'd like to start with your description of Paul Ryan's budget. You called it an $897 billion sinkhole. Why sinkhole?
The budget he proposed, which he claims to take on the tough questions, in fact, really ducks the really tough questions. He puts a line item in under this strange line called allowances, which calls for $897 billion in cuts in discretionary domestic spending over 10 years. That's nearly $1 trillion in cuts. And they are not identified at all. All that we sort of know about them is he and Romney have both said they are not going to cut defense, and then they both have said they're not going to cut veterans' benefits, which are a separate line item. But that leaves uncertain whether that would go to, for example, Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, the EPA, Department of Education, all the other, there's about 17 or so other basic spending categories that could be hit. And the Ryan budget has this, what I call a sinkhole, but it's sort of this blank space that leaves uncertain where they're going to do anything.
You noted in the column that you wrote for the New York Times, five discretionary domestic programs from which you thought it would cut: education, food and drug inspection, workplace safety, environmental protection, and law enforcement.
I looked at most specifically over the 10-year period, but actually the Ryan budget has projections that go out to 2050, which is almost 40 years. This starts getting technical, but he talks about reducing all spending in this category to 3.5% of gross national product, or gross domestic product, whichever one is the one they use. And the fact is that defense already is 4%, and they're not going to cut that. If they're going to keep that promise in the all these out years, there would be nothing left. And that's inconceivable that Congress would eliminate the Department of Justice and Homeland Security, for example. But that's what the implication of this budget is. I mean, the reality is it's just a politically inconceivable document when you start getting into it. And it is not based on any kind of real assessment of what Congress and the government, any president, Republican or Democrat, would do. So it makes a claim of cutting deficits and reducing the national debt that cannot be really backed up by the kind of cuts that they imply. They don't even specify them.
Is it merely rhetoric just to say that they're going to cut?
I don't think any Republican would want to eliminate the FBI, for example, nor would it Homeland Security. Now, those are big chunks of this budget. Veterans benefits are another, which they explicitly said they would not eliminate. There has been talk and some suggestion about eliminating the Department of Education, but it was not clear in that whether they would eliminate all federal aid to education. That's another matter. But what it is basically is phony rhetoric, or it's sort of hidden. It's a claim that doesn't work once it's examined very closely.
So it is primarily rhetoric, or maybe even a dose of wishful thinking on their part.
Well, there's no question that Republicans would like to significantly reduce the welfare state. But a lot of that is in separate parts of the budget. The middle class entitlements, Medicare and Social Security, are both separately funded. They're not discretionary domestic spending. the parts that are more means-tested for the poor, Medicaid, food stamps, unemployment benefits, are also entitlements, and they're not in this category. Ryan is specific about calling for quite substantial cuts in Medicaid, food stamps, and unemployment benefits. He is willing to be specific about what he would cut in programs going to the poor. I think primarily because the poor are not a Republican constituency, and it's a politically cost-free claim for him to make. What he's not willing to do is to identify the programs that are of importance to middle-class voters, which are the ones that make up most of the spending, the non-defense spending, in this category of discretionary domestic spending.
You actually, in your article, said that the federal budget is really divided into these 20 budget functions, which is kind of an odd word. What are budget functions, and what is a function 920?
The budget does have these 20 categories. The first one is, and these are just arbitrary numbers, 050 is national defense. Then the next one is money for international affairs, and that can include direct aid and the State Department and other expenses. Other programs are education, the administration of justice, which includes the FBI, but also the whole Justice Department, Civil Rights Division, all of that. Then there are the regulatory agencies like the SEC and all those network of agencies. There are the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, and some of these are the separate functions. Some fall within broader functions.
You had interviewed some people who were very concerned about veterans' benefits being cut, and then you emailed the Romney campaign, and the exchange you suggest highlights some of the ways that this budget hides their intention.
The Congressional Budget Office, which sort of analyzes the long-term scope of these cuts, it's an independent, nonpartisan, analytical branch of Congress. And the CBO noted that the scope of cuts that are called for in the Ryan budget, really, it would have to be a huge squeezing, if not elimination, of many of these basic programs that most people are quite used to. I mean, you assume your food is going to be inspected by federal inspectors and protected so you won't get salmonella and that kind of thing. The CBO clearly suggested that a lot of that would have to be cut. That I ran into veterans in New Hampshire, or people active with veterans. They assumed that that meant that their program was going to get massacred over time. So I called up the Romney people, and then they said, oh, no, we're not going to touch that. And that then raised the question, well, if they're not going to touch veterans' benefits, what are they going to touch? And that's where they won't get specific. But it was really interviewing these voters up in New Hampshire that prompted me to take a closer look at this.
Well, that connects to another of your columns, which is about this kind of dual campaign that you're seeing from the Romney campaign specifically.
The thrust of that column was basically that they've converted the Medicare issue, cutting Medicare, into actually a racial issue. It's very interesting. The ad says Obamacare calls for a cut of $716 billion from Medicare. And they show a picture of a white older guy, and it says, this is the program you paid into for years, and now you're retiring. You expect to get back in medical coverage what you put in. But Obama wants to give this money to a program that is not, uppercase not, for you, i.e. it's a program to give medical coverage to basically poor people who don't fit under Medicaid. And those people are predominantly, or a much higher percentage of them are minorities, black and Hispanic, than the general population. So it's a transferring from a program that serves overwhelmingly white people, i.e. Medicare, to the expansion of Medicaid to a fundamentally or heavily minority population. And then there's the welfare ad, which is probably better known, but they're claiming that Obama wants to gut the work requirements that were passed in 1996 in the welfare reform. Again, that's pretty clearly an attempt to raise a racial issue. Again, welfare is a racially charged issue in this country.
So your sense is really that these emphasize racial identity in the voting public. And part of that, you noted, might have to do with how the numbers are going with the racial identity of voters.
The larger issue is that Romney campaign and the Republican Party generally is banking on winning with an overwhelmingly white base of support, with little, and if perhaps even less than in the past, support for minorities. It's a significant problem for them because the percentage of the national electorate that is white is steadily declining. In fact, it's declining by about 2 percentage points every 4 years. And so they have to get as high turnout from whites, especially working class whites who've been the biggest defectors from the Democratic Party. The highest turnout among these voters, been known as the Reagan Democrats or the silent majority or angry white men, different categories of names through past elections. They have to turn out in droves. So the idea is behind the welfare and Medicare ads is to boost turnout among these voters, and that's been a problem for them. Obama has basically sought to counter this, especially with the Bain Capital ads attacking Romney's former company for its closure of plants and steel plants and other facilities that white working class guys have been laid off from. There's a sort of a struggle for the soul of white America taking place.
I think the other thing these ads tend to exemplify is the dishonesty. Fact checkers are already criticizing the Romney campaign after the convention. What are they missing?
Well, actually, it's interesting. The Romney campaign during the convention, their chief pollster, Neil Newhouse, I was at a breakfast. They have all these breakfasts at conventions where people talk to the press. And Neil said, "We're not going to let the fact checkers determine how we run our campaign. Basically, they're going to define what they think is legitimate, and they're not going to let critics like fact checkers fear with what they do." What's interesting, though, is that they have used fact checker critiques of pro-Obama ads, anti-Romney ads. They've cited those fact checkers in the past to support their argument that the attack on them has been wrong. Now they're saying they're going to disregard those same people when they criticize their own ads. So they want their cake and eat it too, to put it simply.
These fact checkers are at relatively prestigious organizations, some of the larger institutions, universities, some of the establishment newspapers. But it seems like middle America especially don't really get wind of this information. And so they are stuck believing this material.
The places that run the fact-checker operations, the Washington Post has a fact-checking operation. The Tampa Bay Times has a fact-checking operation. But they don't get national circulation. So that basically the public is not really exposed to these. Secondly, they're in newspapers, which get increasingly less visibility anyway. The circulations are declining. What has happened over time is that campaigns used to be very sensitive about these things. Fact-checking operations used to have real influence over what would be run in a campaign. Over time, campaigns have found that they don't have to pay attention, and they can get away with basically distortions or lies with relatively little penalty. I'm not sure that that, though, is entirely true, because I think it does filter out and that you get enough television commentary and other stuff indicating so that some of the word filters out that a campaign is doing more sort of out-of-bounds stuff than would be normally considered even acceptable. So there may be a cost, and it may be that the democratic system still has some functionality in this area, but it clearly doesn't have as much as it did in the past.
Speaking of our democracy, now we have also another force, these billionaires, like Sheldon Adelson. He's the casino owner billionaire who is also under investigation for bribery. What can you tell us about the investigation of Adelson?
He's under investigation on two fronts. One is an allegation by a former employee. Most of Adelson's money now, or a good chunk of it, comes from Macau, China. and not from his Las Vegas operations. He's a big casino operator, and he's worth somewhere in the area of $24 billion, 14th richest man in the world, I think. And he has made a killing in building casinos in Macau. The guy who really ran the operation there for him has got fired, and then he has filed suit, and in his suit he is charged that there were illicit payments being made in behalf of the Sands Casino operation, say that's the Adelson company, that were basically being used to influence, if not bribe, Chinese officials to either look the other way or not to enforce laws or to allow certain practices. There's a separate United States attorney investigation taking place. The real issue, though, is that nothing has been proven against Adelson at this point, but an American principle is that he is innocent until proven guilty, and he's not been proven guilty of anything. But politicians usually stay 10 miles away from anyone who is under investigation, since the cost, normally speaking, would be too high. But Adelson has already given Romney's super PAC called Restore America, I think it's called, $10 million, and he's expected to come up with a lot more to both that super PAC and others that are on the conservative side. Adelson is adamantly determined to defeat Obama, and Paul Ryan attended a meeting Adelson had at his casino in Las Vegas, and Romney in Jerusalem went to a fundraiser and sat next to Adelson at the fundraiser. Adelson's money has mooted any concerns about the ethics of associating with someone under investigation.
Then there was a lawsuit that was a defamation claim erased.
Well, he threatened one, and he did file another, as I understand it. One that he threatened was against the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. That committee backed off, actually issued kind of an apology. But the other was the Democratic National Jewish Coalition. I may have gotten their names out of order in that. And they have not backed off, and I think that suit is still pending, where they recite some of the allegations made against him. But the allegations have been printed in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal in a lot of publications.
How is the Obama campaign dealing with issues of facts and fact-checkers?
The super PAC that supports Obama, it's called Priorities Today USA, they got into some trouble for an ad that ran primarily on the web, but it did run once on TV, charging that a steel worker lost his wife to cancer after he lost his job at a Bain Capital-controlled company, and he lost his health insurance after that. Turned out that that was not entirely true, so that they had a problem there, but there was a much less has had in comparative airtime to the Medicare and welfare ads, just a tiny fraction. But in fact, the Obama campaign, by most assessments at this point, looks pretty strong, stronger than a lot of people would have expected. And it may be that Romney's behavior and the Romney campaign's sort of playing with the truth is beginning to work against them, and that there would have been a better way to do this for them, and then they chose kind of go through the back alley, and the back alley, it turns out, is not the best avenue to the presidency.
One of the aspects of the Obama campaign that you wrote about was that while he captured the national spotlight in 2004 convention in Boston, he said he was going to unite the country and not have it be divided by party, by race, by identity. And yet his campaign is targeting those. So it's a little bit of a dual campaign as well.
It is. My own view is that Obama's notion that he was going to bring back civility to Washington and the national political debate was naive. I think that he raised expectations that were impossible to meet. The country is deeply polarized, and the degree to which Republicans are opposed to virtually any Democratic initiative is so strong and so intense that thinking that you could make things all pleasant and hunky-dory was just not going to happen. And so he has turned in this campaign back to a strategy focusing more on demographic groups, particularly women. If you saw the and Latinos, those two, I think he assumes he's got black support quite strong. But if you look at the convention, women and Latinos were very strongly emphasized. He is, in many respects, conducting a demographic campaign or a group identity campaign, however you want to describe it.
And then finally, you had a column called Paul Ryan's Liberal Fan Club.
The fact was there were two very strong groups in support of his nomination. One was the conservative wing of the Republican Party, especially like the Weekly Standard and National Review and the writers and thinkers who published there. They wanted the Republican Party to take a really hard conservative line, and Ryan represented that. The other group that wanted it were Democrats, virtually not just liberal Democrats, Democrats of all kinds, because they see the Ryan budget as a big liability. And if Romney's going to run on the Ryan budget, the Democrats see this as an opportunity to win, that the Ryan budget is a losing proposition, that it's alteration of Medicare into a premium support or voucher system, and the costs that it would impose after 10 years on seniors retiring at 65, starting in 2023, and all these cuts that are unidentified but are in there, they saw that as a gold mine from the Democratic point of view as something to run against. And I do quote in that piece two of the folks, at least two, maybe more, from Priorities USA Today, Obama's super PAC. They were licking their chops at the notion that Ryan would get picked. No one expected the Democrats to that Romney would be, from their point of view, foolish enough to do that, but he went ahead and did it.
Well, let's see if it does what he intended for it to do, which is to shore up his base.
But shoring up his base may not be adequate, is the problem.
Thomas Edsel, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thomas Edsel is a columnist at the New York Times and a professor of journalism at Columbia University. When we come back, the role of third parties in shaping American politics historically and today. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Third parties have been at the forefront of some of the nation's most critical social policies and institutional changes, including abolition, women's suffrage, and child labor laws. More recently, polls are revealing that many Americans are dissatisfied with the two-party system, with some 40% of Americans identifying as independent and 48% of eligible voters saying they consider it necessary to create a third party. So why are we still in a two-party system? We have with us three experts. Omar Ali is professor of African diaspora history and politics at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. His books include In the Balance of Power, Independent Black Politics and Third Party Movements in the United States, and In the Lion's Mouth, Black Populism in the New South. He's also director of independentvoting.org. Scott Schraffnagel is director of graduate studies in the Department of Political Science at Northern Illinois University. His publications include Third Party Blues, The Truth and Consequences of Two-Party Dominance, and A Historical Dictionary of the U.S. Congress. David Gillespie also joins us. He is professor of political science at the College of Charleston and the Citadel. He has written extensively on third parties, including the recently published Challengers to Duopoly, Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle. I would like to start with an argument that some scholars have made that great political ideas and transformations in this country have come from third parties. Professor Gillespie, I want to start with you. What would you say third parties have brought to us in terms of important ideas and changes?
Third parties, of course, do not have the resources, the human resources, to push things across the policy line. They rely upon major parties to do that. But they have been generators of some of the great ideas in our history. And you can go back to the anti-Masonic party coming out of that, besides some of the particular controversies of the time, the idea about transparency in government. There were a number of third parties that were interested in doing away with slavery, or at least in not extending slavery. One of those came in out of the cold, the Republican Party. At least six third parties before the Democrats and the Republicans came around to embracing women's suffrage, were working hard for women's suffrage, the elimination of child labor. We, this year, celebrated the 100th anniversary of the first proposal for universal health care, and that was in the Bull Moose Progressive Party platform in 1912. And you can just go on and on and on, the kind of ideas that were incubated in third parties, or third parties worked alongside of interest groups to push the major parties in that direction.
Professor Schroffnagel.
No, I could just add to the list a little. I would agree completely. You know, there's the Wilson-Gorham tariff. The Populist Party was co-sponsored by a member of the Populist Party back in the late 19th century. Whole series of income tax reforms, farm relief, the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, which provides for the direct election of senators, came from third parties. Financial regulations, there's a whole host of things.
And these came from more than one third party?
There's three third parties historically that have been probably the most productive. The anti-Masons that Dr. Gillespie's already referred to, then also the Populist Party of the late 1890s, and then also the Progressive Bull Moose Party coming in the progressive era from 1912 forward.
Professor Ali.
One of the things that I think about when I think about third parties and change in American history is to locate third parties as part of a tactic that independent political movements, various kinds over the course of American history, have engaged in as a way of advancing their agenda, be it a single issue or multiple issues. So I do think that, yes, third parties have played this critical role, everything from the abolition of slavery to, you know, child labor laws to civil rights, et cetera. It's really, I think, a function of larger movements which produce these third parties, which then play a role in the electoral arena. So that's the way that I locate third parties, is that they're essentially a tool of independent movements to advance a certain agenda. And you see that throughout the course of American history. I mean, a basic thing to note is that it's always been the outsiders in American history that have been the engine of change. It's never been the established political parties that adopt change on their own. It's really through pressure from the outside, and third parties have played an important role in creating that kind of pressure at different points in our history.
Give us a couple of examples of these.
The greatest example, in my mind, is the civil rights movement of the 20th century, the mid-20th century. If you listen today to politicians, in particular Democratic politicians, they act as if it was the Democratic Party that led the civil rights movement. That's just plain wrong. It's just not true. It was an independent movement that was organized by people who were or in different political parties and in different associations and different bodies, whether it was the Black Baptist Church or some minor third parties. And they came together and they pressed for certain critical changes that were needed, namely that the federal government needed to intervene and reassert these amendments that had been passed back in Reconstruction to the U.S. Constitution, and that the outcome of that was the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act. So that was an outside movement which was then picked up by, you know, Democratic legislators, in particular in the mid-1960s. To me, that's the greatest example of sort of an outside movement. But you can also look at the populists, and the populists in regards were a movement which then at a certain point, namely by around 1890 or so, form a third party called the People's Party, and again put the pressure on to call for certain kinds of reforms, which they didn't so much see in their generation, but it was in the generation thereafter that many of the reforms that the populists were calling for were actually put into legislation.
So what it sounds like essentially happens is that a movement develops, another party develops within it. This advocacy then is adopted by a traditional party, and maybe, I mean, I hate to use the word co-opted, but is it co-opt? David Gillespie, would you think that that's appropriate here?
Co-optation is certainly a word that is applicable. appropriation or a theft would also be terms that could be used. And of course, when third parties have their ideas stolen or appropriated, they may feel cheated by that, but very oftentimes the most important third parties live short lives precisely for that reason. There are third parties that are sort of flashes in the pan. They may last one election round, or they may last for 10 years or something, but then they're gone. And one reason for that is that appropriation or co-optation has taken place.
That's actually a perfect leeway into the bigger question of this whole thing, which is some of these third parties emerge and become forces like the Republican Party. Others start as forces and die out, like I think the Whig Party. What determines whether or not a party is going to maintain a part of the political fabric or is going to fade out? Scott Schroffnagel?
The bottom line is that the last third party to rise up and become a major party was the Republican Party, and that took civil war. It was a complete disjuncture within the party system at the time that, you know, created this opportunity for a third party. But we haven't had that happen since. Every third party has been short-lived since that time. And there's rules and election rules and laws that are in place that have helped to create two-party dominance. Most specifically, you know, we have a type of election in this country for the legislatures. It's called a single-member district with a plurality rule, which means whoever gets the most votes wins. And under those election conditions, right, there will only be two parties, two dominant parties. So the only chance a third party would ever have under the current election format is to try to replace one of the major parties. But then we'd be back to a two-party system. You know, back to the earlier point about some of the ideas that third parties have had, I just would like to add that when I answered your question, I was thinking about very direct and obvious sort of causal sort of specific piece of legislation. If you add, you know, just the ideas, now the influence of third parties has been even greater.
Omar Ali?
Yes, I mean, I agree completely. I think that, you know, sort of independent and third parties have played a major role in shaping the vision of what America is at different points. I don't think that there is a single reason, because at different moments there are different factors at play, but certainly in the latter part of the 20th century, to go back to what you were saying about the election laws being discriminatory and the, you know, the rules and the election, the system, just the issue of ballot access. So, for instance, if you want to run as a third-party candidate and get on the ballot in all 50 states, it requires something like 20 times the number of signatures than if you're a Democrat or Republican. And the reason why is because the legislators, the Democrats and Republicans in office, write the election laws to basically keep themselves in power. They do that in other ways. For instance, the ways that, you know, districts are formed, you know, every 10 years, the redistricting is done on partisan lines. It's not done in some sort of logical way, again, to favor one or the other major party. You have the issue of primaries or closed primaries, which basically lock out independents in something like half of the states right now. So there are a number of ways in which the two major parties create rules and regulations to keep themselves in power. So that's a problem, and most people aren't aware of that unbelievable kind of discrimination that's going on. So we have basically anybody who's not in a third party, essentially they have to deal with a set of laws that make them effectively a second-class citizen, not to over sort of make the connection to, you know, the kind of suffering and trauma and victimization of black people under Jim Crow. But in the law, there really is a second-class status for independents and third-party candidates. And the reason why you don't hear about most of them is because it takes enormous resources for them to be in any way competitive. So we heard about Ross Perot in 1992, but he put in $70 million of his own money. But the Democratic and Republican parties start off their national campaigns with $50 million taxpayer money each. So the regular person or even a smaller third party has no way of competing in a meaningful way. So it's a discriminatory, it's undemocratic, and that's the system that we have.
This is David Gillespie. I think it would be very important to point out that what we really have in contemporary America is not so much a free-flowing two-party system. That existed in the 19th century. What we have now is a duopoly, and I mean by that an imposed two-party system in which the ideal for the architects of that system, and I don't mean that in any conspiratorial sort of way, but just in the natural order of power holders using power for themselves, the ideal is to eliminate all third parties entirely. In the 19th century, before the secret ballot came in the 1880s, the parties did their own ticket making. We still talk about the Democratic ticket or the Green ticket or something like that, but we've forgotten what that meant. It meant in the 19th century that third parties printed their own ballots and distributed them when people went to vote, and people voted publicly. Obviously, it was a great step forward from the standpoint of secrecy when we went to secret ballot, but that put the ballot access in the hands of the states. And by 1930, the states were hell-bent in using that to exclude parties other than the Democrats and Republicans. I think what Scott was talking about, the single-member district, is probably the principal reason why we have two parties. And we could talk about that single-member district being very important. I can't say that that institution was instituted for the purpose of discrimination, because single-member district is older than what most democracies use today, which is the PR system, and which is conducive to a multi-party system.
That's proportional representation for our listeners that don't know PR, proportional representation.
That's right. But we have added to that these deliberate discriminatory things that Omar was talking about, including ballot access and debate discrimination and all of these kinds of things. And the intent is to close the door on it. Britain today has a real two-party system. It uses single-member district for its national elections, but the access to the ballot is equal for every person seeking access to the ballot, and it is a low threshold. It involves collecting a few signatures on a petition and paying a very small filing fee, and that's not the way we conduct business.
Now, speaking of closed primaries, single district, that sort of a thing, now California is experimenting with open primaries so that top two go. There are a lot of complaints about what that's actually going to do. Will it open the door for third-party candidates?
This is David Gillespie. Top two is yet another thing that probably was not intended to discriminate against third parties, but has that effect, because what it does is to open the primary so broadly that, you know, it basically takes the party role out, and at the general election, it's very unlikely that any third-party candidate is going to appear. They will disappear in that top two primary system. So I don't like that system from the standpoint of yet another barrier that has been erected that discriminates.
Scott Strafnagel?
There's really five different election arrangements, if you will, that influence third parties. Ballot access laws is one. The nature of primaries, whether they're closed and open. Another that we haven't mentioned yet is the fusion candidate. A candidate can run under multiple party labels. But then going back to what I talked about, single-member districts and plurality rule. Now, my work has shown that of those five issues, it's the single-member district plurality rule that is the real culprit. And actually, I've been able to trace, I don't know if I'd call it a conspiracy, but some of there's mention in the congressional record from the 1840s when Democrats and Whigs were the two major parties, and some of these single-member district plurality rule laws were written. They were, multi-member districts were the norm when the Congress was first formed. And there is evidence that they were doing it on purpose to promote a two-party system, not because they necessarily were trying to kill third parties at that time, but that they thought it was going to be more effective. And, you know, and a lot of times when people debate this party system, whether a two-party system or a multi-party system is best, that debate centers on two-party dominance, which we have today, versus multi-party systems. They fail to realize that there are other party options, particularly like a two-and-a-half-party system, which we experienced in the progressive era and to a certain extent in the populist era. But ballot access laws and closed primaries and fusion candidates, I have found that they are statistically linked to lower third-party voting, but not enough to make a difference, not enough for them to win. If we're going to have effective third parties, we'll have to dismantle single-member district plurality rule. Short of that, it's not going to happen.
Isn't that, particularly with congressional races and senatorial races, that embedded in the Constitution?
Not at all. The only thing the Constitution says about elections is that states should do their own thing. And so what I would imagine, you know, if reform were to ever come, it would come in the states that allow for initiatives, just like we have states now that have legalized gambling or gay marriages. Those states where you allow the people to have some say, they would be the ones to first experiment. And the irony is that multi-member districts are not completely foreign to the American system, right? Illinois had multi-member districts up till 1980 for state legislators. That's the state I live in, but many states still have multi-member districts. All of our city councils and county commissions are often multi-member. So it's not a foreign concept, and majority rule is not a foreign concept either. And so we're talking about moving from plurality rule to majority rule, single-member district to multi-member district. That's the key. That's what would make the difference. That's what would allow third-party success. I would guess the only way it's going to ever happen, it would have to happen sort of state by state with experimentation.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the role of third parties in American politics. Well, it seems California is starting to experiment, at least on the city level, with the single transferable voting. I don't want to get into the technicalities of that, but it is one way of ranking candidates and therefore being able to vote for more than one candidate in rank order, which allows some to vary their preferences. But California actually links us into another issue, which is the rise of people who are independent. I understand California's decline to state a particular party, its ballot designation is decline to state a party, is among the fastest growing parties. Do we see this trend anywhere else? Omar Ali, I know you particularly study African Americans. What can you tell us about independent voters who don't register with parties?
Independent voters who don't register with parties are the fastest growing grouping of people in America in terms of the election system. It's sort of astonishing how fast the growth is. Here in North Carolina, 2 out of 3 new registered voters are registering as unaffiliated, which is what we have as the category that's not Democratic or Republican or Libertarian. It is unaffiliated. So it's the fastest growing. It's just past the 25-26% mark. And if you look at that in relationship to also what it is that the Gallup and Pew and other national polls are indicating, somewhere between 40-42% of Americans as a whole are now self-identifying as independent. Now, many political scientists will say, well, the true independents are actually much smaller because they either lean for, towards the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. But I don't think that that's fair, because if people are simply presented with 2 viable options, that is a candidate that will win, if they're asked a follow-up question, which way do you lean? Then I think, of course, people are going to tend to go one way or the other because they want to have some impact on the outcome of the general election. But this phenomena, the rise of the independent voter, is just absolutely fascinating. And the thing that you see is that people aren't registering en masse into third parties. They're saying they don't want to register into any political party. They don't want to be part of any particular grouping of people necessarily. So what's interesting is that a lot of these people are forming essentially the margin of victories, as we saw in 2008 with President Obama. And to go back to the question of African Americans, we had basically a black and independent alliance providing his margin of victory, something like 96-97% African American voters going for the president in the general election. And he won about 8-point margin of independence against Senator McCain. And it was independents and also African Americans that carried him in the primaries. So independents are playing this very important role, not only in North Carolina, but in California and across the country, really. But I do want to respond to something that David said about the top two, which is I take a slightly different stance than him. I think that top two for me in California is actually a positive reform. It's a positive reform because it allows independent voters who are more often than not barred from party primaries to effectively fully participate in the electoral process. And it also breaks the hold of the political parties on the candidate selection process. So for third-party advocates, it's not great. But if you're looking at it from the perspective of independents, that is those outside of the two major parties who don't affiliate with a third party, then it's a great thing because it starts to challenge the sort of the control that the two major parties have on the selection process of their candidates. So independents are on the rise, and African Americans are also diversifying. Right now, the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies is reporting about close to 30% of African Americans self-identifying as independent. So we're seeing this across the sort of the age, race, gender, and ideological spectrum of America.
David Gillespie, let's bring you back in. Let's address some of the more modern third parties as well. We saw Ralph Nader run a couple of times. We have one senator who's independent, Bernie Sanders. We talked about Ross Perot, and we also have Mayor Bloomberg.
Well, you would like to think that that indicates some opening. We actually have a third party or an independent governor of Rhode Island, and in Maine, it looks like something is going to happen in which an independent candidate is going to make it to the U.S. Senate this fall. So there are always these things on the periphery, but still the cards are very stacked. And I would really come to how people look at this. I think Omar is exactly right. When you look at the Gallup polls over the last 10 or 15 years, you see that people affirm that the two major parties are serving us so poorly that we need to have at least one major alternative to the Democrats and the Republicans. And the rate of affirmation ranges from something like 40% in some years up to about 53%. I saw the poll recently, and the most recent Gallup poll says that a plurality now, not a majority, but a plurality, still affirm that we need a third party. And what you oftentimes hear people say, political scientists call it voting strategically or voting tactically. What ordinary citizens call it is voting for the lesser of two evils. And, you know, that is sort of part of the popular culture. Don't throw your vote away. Don't vote with your heart. Vote with your head. Vote for the major party candidate that you can live with if you can't live with both of the major party candidates. So this whole issue of spoiling is a real problem for third parties. There are some institutional proposed reforms in the instant runoff voting, for example, which would have, I think you mentioned that in one of your questions, but instant runoff voting would allow a person to cast a first choice vote for his heart and then cast a second choice vote for his head or her head if you wanted to, and you don't have the sense of throwing your vote away. There is also the National Popular Vote Compact movement to try to reform the electoral college system, which also discriminates against third parties without going through the constitutional amendment process, which would be impossible to change. So there are some interesting movements out there, but I think still that problem is the idea that you can't throw your vote away. If you vote for a third party candidate, you're throwing it away and you're electing the major party candidate that you less would like to see.
I'm certain that the mass media compound that with the way that they cover elections. Scott Schraffnagel.
Well, you know, in terms of successful third-party candidates in the modern era, we get them. But more often than not, I mean, there's only a couple of ways it happens. One is they've got a boatload of their own money that they're willing to spend. They've got name recognition through sports or celebrity of some sort, or they're a former Democrat or Republican. But minus those qualities, minus celebrity or your own money or formerly successful Democrat or Republican, now there's just almost no third-party success or independent candidate success. And the reason is very clear. It's what Dr. Gillespie's talking about. People don't want to waste their votes. Under single-member district plurality rule, if you were to plot people's preferences over on a scatter plot, you would find that it would take on a bell shape. And at the top of that bell is somebody called the median voter, and there's only two sides to that median voter, which means there's only room for two political parties. It doesn't do any good for parties to form on the left or the right because they're not going to win. any district that you sit down in, its constituents, their preferences are going to take on a bell shape. It's a statistical law. So there's a mathematical reason, but there's also the psychological reason that Dr. Gillespie refers to, and that is that people don't want to waste their vote. Why am I going to vote for my heart and who I really want if I know they don't have any chance of winning? And so under the current election laws, third parties can't win.
One of you wrote about Mayor Bloomberg and his fusion campaign. Of course, he has his own money and he had name ID also. But without the fusion, Republican and independent, could he have won?
That was me, Omar. I talk about it in my first book, In the Balance of Power. That was a fascinating sort of campaign because in New York City, most people are Democrats. And what happened was that he was personally fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. And he had never run for office, and he decides that he's going to take a shot at it. And so he sees that the Democrats, there were like five people gunning for the nomination, and he looked at the Republicans, and there was one other person. So he said, okay, well, I can get my name on that ballot if I can beat out the other Republican. And then he went and asked the Independent Party of New York if they would support him, getting him on the ballot, and they would run, you know, a fusion campaign, which is allowed in very few places, in New York being one of them. And that margin which he won was attributed in good part to the Independence Party of New York, and not just the number of votes that he won on the Independence Party line, but in terms of the organizing that the Independence Party was engaged in communities of color. One of the founders of that party was actually the first woman and the first African-American to get on the ballot in all 50 states in the United States. This was 20 years before Barack Obama. And her name is Dr. Lenora Fulani. And Fulani did that in 1988 by winning 11 election state suits and gathering about 1.5 million signatures. The entire campaign was geared around trying to simply break that barrier. And 4 years later, when Ross Perot decided that he was going to run, who did he go to but none other than Dr. Fulani's attorneys to get help on how to actually get on the ballot because they're so difficult, in some places virtually impossible. So New York had this fascinating thing which brought together the Independence Party, which was multiracial and working in different communities of color and in poor and working class communities, which allowed Bloomberg to have some sort of authority in those communities. And many people went out and voted for him because of that connection. So independence in New York City played a critical role, and I don't think by himself running as a Republican. And now, by the way, he's re-registered to be unaffiliated, so he is now independent, which goes to show you that there are many people in America that are just sort of pragmatic, and they register whatever party is most helpful that they see at that time. And he is reflecting in some ways a larger sentiment in America, which is moving away from registering and being part of any political party.
Given the election coming up in November, just less than 2 months away now, we still have some minor parties trying to field candidates in various races. And I know the Green Party has an impressive candidate for president. If we are not able to hear her in the debates or grant her status that she needs to be considered, what is the role that these minor parties are going to be able to play? Will they be able to play the kind of historic roles that we've seen throughout American history in bringing these important issues forward?
They can, clearly. I mean, the best example of that probably is Ross Perot in 1992. I mean, he came up with the idea of a balanced budget, you know, that, I mean, people had talked about it, but it brought it to the American public's attention, you know, through 30-minute infomercials with his charts, and people saw that we were, you know, spending more than we were bringing in, and you know, I would argue whoever got elected in 92 was going to have to address the budget deficit, which Bill Clinton and then the subsequent Republican Congress do successfully. And so the point is that third parties can still be that engine for new ideas, but you know, at some point, you know, I think a third party might like to win something. You know, right now the deck's so stacked against them, the best they can do is play a spoiler role And more often than not, that's not in the best interest of the third-party advocates, right? So if that third-party presidential candidate is coming from the left or the right, if they spoil it for the Democrat or the Republican, respectively, they're that much worse off.
It certainly cost Ralph Nader a great deal of empathy, sympathy, relationships when he ran and people called him a spoiler.
Ralph Nader has a very good response to that, and it is that a major party candidate is much more likely to rob votes from a minor party candidate because of that very issue of spoiling. And I remember in 2000, so many Democratic signals, don't throw your vote away on Ralph Nader. And those people who voted for Ralph Nader voted for Ralph Nader. And it was obscene, in my opinion, for the Democrats in that case, or the Republicans in the case of Ross Perot, to say you robbed us of the election. Because, you know, people who take that step of stepping outside the major parties and voting for an independent or third party candidate intend to do that. And I think they go into that fully aware that probably their candidate is not going to win, but it's important to vote principle sometimes.
On that note, I recall an article in the American Political Science Association's journal about the Ralph Nader election, specifically in Florida. And the finding was that the people who voted for him actually were not going to vote had he not been in the election.
Absolutely. And when you focus on Florida, probably the official count would have been on Al Gore's side had it not been for the thousands of votes that went to Ralph Nader. But those people who voted for Ralph Nader intended to vote for Ralph Nader. It was not a mistake on their part. And many of them, as you say, and studies have shown this, would not have voted had it not been for Nader's candidacy. Between the two major parties, they agree on nothing but pulling the ladder up against third parties. And they don't agree on anything by way of policy. And we're totally paralyzed because what the Democrats gain, the Republicans lose, and vice versa, you know. So I think our system is paralyzed by our duopoly now.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. Omar Ali is professor of African diaspora history and politics at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. His books include In the Balance of Power, Independent Black Politics and Third Party Movements in the United States, and In the Lion's Mouth, Black Populism in the New South. He's also director of independentvoting.org. Scott Schrafnagel is director of graduate studies in the Department of Political Science at Northern Illinois University. His publications include Third Party Blues, The Truth and Consequences of Two-Party Dominance, and A Historical Dictionary of the U.S. Congress. David Gillespie, he is professor of political science at the College of Charleston and the Citadel. He has written extensively on third parties, including the recently published Challengers to Duopoly, Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.